Welcome back to another episode of the Equity Matters Podcast. This is Charles, that is JB3. And I feel like it's been a long 2 weeks since the last time that we all connected. First off, rest in peace, Takeoff. Like, what is that? I talked about it on my Twitter page, but those who know me personally know that the Migos are kind of integral to my development as a husband. When we got married, Fight Night, Handsome and Wealthy, Freak No More, and all of those tracks were like really booming at the time, and they were like the soundtrack to the beginning of our marriage. And so to lose an artist like Takeoff, who for me in many ways resembles how I approach leadership, kind of quiet, kind of subtle, collaborative though. People just know you for your authenticity, for your willingness to participate and just do the work. I took that kind of hard. And so every time that we lose a black man who didn't have a chance to grow old, I'm stricken with grief. Being a parent of black boys, obviously, and I've got a black brother, I've got frat brothers, myself included, it's scary out there. And I guess that's what brings us to today's episode. When we think about the status quo, or as we've often talked about on the podcast, disrupting the status quo. And we broached this conversation around social innovation. And social innovation takes on many different definitions as the social entrepreneurs, but it's really about the design of solutions that will disrupt and ultimately improve the well-being and the welfare of individuals and communities. And so if you're new to the podcast, you need to know that all of my work since I've started social work, or even before I became an MSW, has really been rooted in this notion of community knows best. And as we found throughout the pod, is communities not always pulled into the conversations. And so social innovation really partners with community intentionally, but it's really about aiming to meet social needs in a better way than our existing solution. So when you pair community input and community voice with that process, you come up with better solutions. It's simple as that. Today's episode, we're going to hear from Heather Hiscox, who is a social entrepreneur in her own right, who has been working with this group that she founded called Pause for Change as a way of getting government entities, people like me, to think outside of the box, or maybe get back inside of the box and start to think about what limitations the box has created. And so with that, I am excited to introduce you all to Heather Hiscox. Heather, let the folks know a little bit about you and what brings you to the work that you're doing today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Oh, what brings me to the work is frustration, honestly, is being a frustrated change maker, you know, working within the sector, which I consider to be nonprofit, local government, and philanthropy. I consider that the intersection of social change, and working in different elements of that sector my whole career, just seeing how we go about trying to change the world using status quo skills to solve and address these different problems. And what brings me to the work is wanting to interrogate and redesign how we do the work.
I think in many ways, I tell folks this all the time. It's like they ask, how did I start the podcast? And the same words come to mind, like a point of frustration. You know, people were talking about equity and social justice in ways that I felt was just so ugh. And I was like, there's got to be people out there who get it, who are willing to challenge the status quo, or people who just have these great examples of what it means to be equity minded, or to center equity in their work. And so I can truly relate when you talk about like coming from a point of frustration, like I have to create the thing that I want to see, because otherwise everyone's going to keep doing the same old thing.
Exactly. Yeah. You look around and in the beginning, you feel like you're the only one. Like, does anyone else notice what's going on here? And the tricky thing about using these status quo skills is that they're being used in every organization, in every community across the entire US, and I would wager a bet that it's, globally. So if you think about knowing that there's another way to work, they could reduce that waste of time, energy, effort, hope, and all those resources into solutions that would be more impactful. Just anything could be possible. And to think about, some of the weak impact that we're creating and knowing that we could do better. It drives my passion for the work of trying to help people see how with just some simple changes they really can transform the work.
So let the listeners know a little bit about like your educational background. Like what type of perspectives and theories do you bring to the work? And then let's describe exactly what the work is.
Yeah, that's great. I have a very winding journey to arrive to this point, which I love. I love meeting other people with winding journeys, and some people call it multi-passionate. My undergrad is in sociology and social injustice, and I have a minor in African American studies. And then I have a master's in public health and health disparities. And so I would say, since I was young, young and young, and being, a white woman with freckled skin and red hair, blue eyes, it doesn't quite match the expectation or picture that people would have. But since I was very young, I grew up with a Latin American family. My grandmother's actually Costa Rican. My mom looks just like me, but her name was Rosita. We grew up with a lot of focus on social justice and diversity and really valuing all people. So that really framed how I was raised and the education that I sought. So all my interests and all my work have always been focused on social justice. I've taken a couple little turns here and there. I did clinical research for a while for NIH-funded studies and Academic Health Center, and that was fascinating because I learned that I love hypotheses and testing and finding answers and working with people, some of them in their most dire time of need, and then developing programs and designing and evaluating programs and creating all the elements that go into that, and then fundraising. And what's been interesting about all these different elements of my career is that every step along the way, I've learned more and more about what we can do better and how we can do better. So I think that's the through line. Even though I've been in different areas of the sector and different types of work, I've always been that troublemaker, asking, why do we do it this way? Who said? What if? Why can't we? So that's also been a consistent thread and theme. And so the work I do now is Pause for Change. That's the company pauseforchange.com. I have a proprietary proven framework that I've been building over a decade to work with social sector organizations to help them address challenges and to use new skills, ditch those status quo problem-solving skills and really use new skills to address internal and external challenges. So I work all over the country and I get to work with amazing teams to help them execute and implement these changes.
So let's take a step back and let's really level set today's conversation. For those who are not familiar, could you define the term social innovator, social innovation?
For me, social innovation is all about redesigning social systems and structures. I know at its level, a lot of people think that social innovation and social entrepreneurship is just another version of like a type of business, right? It could be a 501c3, it could be an L3C, a benefit corporation, a B Corp, like a different way of looking at the business, which, yeah, that's an element of it. But for me, social innovation is about how do we create value in our social systems, recognizing that these are systems rooted and built upon and buttressed by oppression. And they were designed to operate in the ways that they do operate. And because they were designed, we can interrogate those practices, we can dismantle those practices, and we can redesign what's possible. So to me, social innovation is really examining and redesigning and rebuilding what's possible to address social systems to make sure that everyone has access to freedom and liberation and the full expression of who they are and their humanity and get to live full lives.
You know, one of the things that resonates and just rings the alarm for me is thinking about the phrase that we've all heard, like this is the way that we've always done it, right? And I think people just get so comfortable with this is the way that we've always done it that they're not even imaginative anymore. Like they're not even thinking about how can we expand, how can we build capacity, or how can we stop doing this and focus on something else. And I think even coming from a public space of like the public sector is like we don't have to continue doing things this way. Like despite the fact that it's gotten us to this point, it's gotten us to this point with some challenges, with some obstacles. And in many ways, we might be perpetuating the inequities that we're supposed to address. Is that really just keeping the lights on, or are we really trying to make change?
Yeah, it's so true. I see it all the time of I think there's a couple things at play. Part of it is we have organizational habits and cultural habits of how we try to solve problems, and we don't even recognize that we're doing it, right? There's some sort of cue or stimulus. We take action and then there's a reward. And so sometimes I'll talk to teams about that habit cycle of how do we, when we have a cue, we're always going to have some sort of cue that's like, oh, something's wrong, or we could do better, or there's a pain point, or something's happening. But instead of just rushing to solutions and creating that waste and weak impact, how can we interrupt that cycle and identify that our potential solutions have a ton of uncertainty, so we need to take on new skills in that area of uncertainty to get to a new reward. So I think that's one thing is habits. And then the other thing is that there are We see everything in terms of this is the way we've always done it, and we tried that before and it didn't work, and these are expectations. They create these constraints that really they do limit people's thinking because they don't think there is flexibility in trying something new. But if you look at policies, procedures, practices, those didn't arrive from on high and we're like stuck with them for eternity. They were created by other people. And we as people can also recreate them and reimagine what is possible. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
In my doctoral program, there was a huge emphasis on social innovation. And as we were putting together our capstones, a lot of the feedback that we got was, this isn't innovative enough. This isn't innovative enough. And so I'm curious from your perspective, what should we be thinking when we're thinking of being innovative?
Yeah, oh. Yes, that is so common. You know, the definition for me of innovation is creating new value, right? And it's understanding that we're here to create value for each other. So even if it's an, you know, colleagues, internal stakeholders for together, you know, how do we create value and solve problems for each other? And then external stakeholders, how do we create value? And I think what happens is usually there's a couple breakdowns. We go straight to brainstorming because that's normal, right? When we hit uncertainty, our body hates uncertainty. It gives us headaches, backaches, tummy aches, all those things. And so what makes us feel better is that release of juicy chemicals when we choose a path forward. So sometimes I think that we jump right into brainstorming and we don't see opportunities for innovation. We just fall into those same traps that are limited by our biases, that are limited by our positionalities and our perspectives. So we accidentally just recreate and reproduce what we've experienced before. I think the other breakdown happens when, so we brainstorm too prematurely. We don't actually engage stakeholders to co-design solutions, but we brainstorm in the sector with this really deficit mindset where we're like, okay, we have 5 minutes, five people, we have $5. What can we do? And we already just cut ourselves off at the knees. Like we can't even think bold and big. And you know what I've seen with some of the teams that I've worked with, and what I tell them is I want you to brainstorm potential solutions that make you embarrassed to say them out loud or write them on a sticky note. I don't want you to consider feasibility. I don't want you to consider people's perspectives and what like your colleagues will say if you offer this up. Because what's interesting is through solution testing, you actually can get to a higher place where you beyond what you ever could imagine in terms of the innovation level of what you can offer and what you can potentially design. And I've seen it happen time and again, but we just aren't supported to do that big, bold brainstorming. And then we just, you know, get cozy with what we're used to and we just fall back in line.
So thinking about the other folks out there who do this work, what are some of the common traits shared among social innovators? So one thing I hear is just being bold, right? The thing that I always like to raise is be curious, right? Like ask the questions, ask why, ask how. But other things that you would say line up in that way, and how do they show up?
People that are curious, that is a really a first step, right? Just that curiosity of why is it this way? Who created it? When was it created? For what purpose? How do I know whether it's working or not? And that's why, you know, I called my framework PAUSE, and it's an acronym because we rarely pause in our work. We are so busy. We're just go, go, go. But we really need to pause and look around and ask those big questions. And it's very interesting how we do just move forward. We're not really active and actively engaged in critical thinking and critical interrogation. So curiosity, I think, is huge. And just, you know, having a space where you can connect with others that think this way, I think is really big because I know my thinking has been expanded from engaging with folks like you, right? Like, how do you see the world? What are you trying? What are you learning? What are you reading? So it's just adding more and more resources to my toolkit and just being open to understanding that how I see the world is only how I see the world at that moment. And there's so many opportunities to expand and to learn with others that can benefit, you know, myself and so many others that I also interact with.
Now, this wouldn't be Equity Matters if we didn't ask the equity questions, right? And I'm curious as to how can these models of social innovation be used to advance equity? Because you mentioned earlier, in many ways, the systems are designed to function the way that they design. And a lot of times those are rooted in either, you know, white supremacy, whiteness, or white ideologies that perpetuate oppression. So how do we undo that and advance equity at the same time?
Yeah, I think the biggest issue is power. I think we really have to look at who benefits from these systems, right? Who are the quote unquote winners and losers, right? Sort of that winners take all model. You know, yeah, I think it really a lot of it is the source of it is power. Of thinking about who has access to power, how do you share power? Who's willing to acknowledge their power and their influence, and who's willing to relinquish that? And I think the other big piece that connects to equity for me is accountability. Who is holding people accountable, and what are the consequences? What are the real consequences that people will experience that will impact the status that they get to enjoy, that will impact their power? And you know, how do we keep accountability at the forefront? I think that is a huge issue. Because what happens in the sector is there's this perceived altruism that I'm here to help, that white saviorism, you know, complex and all of that. But it just feeds into that nonprofit industrial complex and some of those other savior complexes that are really creating a lot of harm that is unrecognized and uninterrogated. So I think there's a couple different layers to it.
Could you give us an example of, you know, the ways that we can share power? Because that's something that's come up quite a bit in the trainings that I offer. Because I talk about the different forms of power and I give examples of how power shows up in collaborative relationships. But what does it really mean for an organization to say, hey, we acknowledge we have power, but we could be doing more if we actually shifted it? Could you describe what that looks like?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is co-design. I think that is really one of the first areas to explore, and it's thinking about the harm that there's the decisions and actions you've taken have caused. But you only learn that by understanding another person's lived experience and their living experience. You know, related to the work at Creative Action Lab and Antoinette Carroll's work, it's present. It's not just past, right? It's lived and living. And I think with co-design, you really get a chance to have an empathetic approach, start to build an authentic relationship with stakeholders that are seen as external to an organization. You know, it's sort of that I design for you, not with you. So shifting that model and really helping staff understand their biases and their positionalities and really pointing them out to each other, and then seriously committing to co-design and continual co-creation with stakeholders, most often community members most impacted, to understand that you as a leader of the organization or a program are probably not the expert that of course community members are. So it's just starting to understand who should hold power and how to provide equal access.
You know, it's hard to tell people that we're not the experts, right? And I've been in those conversations, and you know, we're doctorally prepared, and we're out in these spaces. It's like, hey, we've done a lot, we've learned a lot, but we don't know everything, and we don't have the detail of what it's like to navigate in these particular spaces. And when you talk about design, I'm immediately brought back to just the conversation of, I've mentioned it here before, nothing about us without us as part of your research principles or as part of your program design principles. Like from the very beginning, even before we get to like collecting data, like are you actually centering community in the process of forming the question? Because I find what happens 9 times out of 10 is we've created the problem, therefore we're going to create the solution. And we've wasted lots of money on a problem that we created that might not even be the problem that community is facing, right? It's like we're addressing the hole over here when the house is on fire over there.
Oh yeah, and I have a great story that I love to share. That's from a local government client. Their challenge was that they had seen an increase in crime in an area, in a segment of the community, and they had all the data, right? They could state a really clear case that anyone looking at it would say, yeah, there's been an increase in crime. What's going on? And so this team went out and started interviewing community members and just reaching out, and every single community member they talked to said, I feel safe overall. I've lived here most of my life. I know most of my neighbors. I feel pretty comfortable. What I want to talk about is affordable housing because my landlord is, nowhere to be found. I have rats and cockroaches. My rent is being increased 20% a year, and this is not okay. And the city needs to get involved. They have got to step up. I'm fine. They even had a woman that said that there was a drive-by shooting and she had to dive to cover the body of her child to protect her child during the shooting. And even she said affordable housing is the number one priority because it's getting out of hand. And so this team was looking around like, oh, wait, well, what do? We're here to talk about crime. But they had to pivot. From the very beginning, they had to pivot and totally shift their thinking, and they focused the entire rest of the challenge on affordable housing.
You know, that's great, right? Like that is a perfect example of how we shift our resources to address an emerging or just a need that's been there, right? Like I feel like in many cases, I find myself more in the public health space, and we talk about the social determinants of health, yet we don't address them in the same way. And so it's easy for us to say, hey, you know, that's housing's problem, or hey, that's transportation's problem. No, guys, like if we really mean health in all policies, or if we really mean, you know, all of these things are health or help to contribute to health, we need to go ahead and pick up the phone and call whoever that person is. And I think in many cases, that's how you create those new relationships. And that is how you share your power because you have the resources, you have the bandwidth to say, hey, affordable housing is the issue that we should be addressing. So how do we get the housing commission on board? How do we talk to the housing authority? How do we take this conversation that we've had and give it meaning and action?
Absolutely. And it's so common, like you said, and it's that siloing and that hierarchy of like, who me? Not me, them. It's them. You acquiesce, right? You don't take responsibility and you pass it to the next person and they have a whole other set of priorities and agendas and issues. And they're like, wait, us now? Not now. And so you just get this like shifting, where no one takes responsibility, no one has accountability, and the community suffers. And Organizations will often wait till it reaches the crisis point, which is, of course, not acceptable.
So I know Pause for Change is your baby, right? And I think the way that we came to meet each other was through Possibility Project, which one, I'm just inspired by the name. But could you tell folks a little bit about what it is, how it came to be?
Yes, yeah. Possibility Project is I call it a disruptive conversation series. And it's essentially, it was created back in March 2020. My co-founder at the time, Devin Davey, and I were having conversations with, with COVID and the murder of George Floyd and others. We thought, oh my goodness, like this is a time of change. This is a time of reimagination. And especially in this sector and what we are seeing in headlines and in other places, we thought we want to be part of having conversations that are like the ones that we used to have with friends in like dark corners of cafes after you look over the booth a couple times and you get to say like all the things. And for us, after COVID started, we were really nourished by those conversations with our colleagues. And we said, why don't we bring this to the sector overall and bring change makers together that are frustrated and that do want to, disrupt how we do the work? And so the first episode was in May of 2020. And we're about to have our 31st episode in March. And it's a very interactive setup where we invite 2 to 3 panelists to come and talk about a topic. So next month we're talking about code switching in the sector. Today we had an episode that was all about how do we train the next generation of change makers, and is higher education really the place best equipped to do that? We just talk about all these different topics with most of our speakers are diverse, 80% are BIPOC. And we invite a community to participate in those conversations as well. So we have our key panelists that are answering the two questions we ask in every episode, which is what dysfunctions do you want to disappear around the topic, and what's emerging that gives you hope? And that's focused on action and resources and inspiration. But we have a very active community just on LinkedIn alone, about 755 people that join in, that attend live, that watch the recordings, that are engaged on social. So they do have support. And then, yeah, it's just an active space for people to really come and have these types of chats with each other and have that support.
Now, one of the things that I meant to ask you prior was, how do we translate the hope and the aspiration into action? Because I think that's what happens in many initiatives. Like people get really excited, right? You get riled up, motivated, ready to go, but then you get back into the machine in the cog of the cycle of like the routine of things. How do we translate the lessons learned that come out of things like Possibility Project into tangible, actionable steps that says, hey, I got to disrupt.
Yeah, there are so many, and I know some of these experts, and I put them in air quotes, wouldn't want to be called experts, but there are so many experts out there that have fantastic frameworks and tools and resources that we never slow down to really explore and to figure out how to integrate. So I think part of the answer is just slowing down a minute and giving ourselves time to integrate new learning and to share it within our organizations and get people's feedback. And that's one of the interesting and unexpected things that we've heard people are doing with Possibility Project episodes. They're watching them as a team, and they're pausing them, and they're having critical conversations within their own organizations where they're saying, how does white supremacy show up in our work? How does power show up in our work? How are we really holding ourselves accountable? What does allyship really mean to us? And so I think that's key. You can hear a theoretical discussion, you can be inspired, but if you don't try to integrate it into your own experience and into your work by just at the first part, just thinking about it. That's the most simple step. And then accessing these experts and these tools and these frameworks that can really guide step by step how to incorporate new skills into the work. And there are so many amazing people to support this work, to guide organizations in asking new questions and starting to shift their culture and take on new behaviors. They do not have to do it alone. But I think it goes back to accountability. Who's watching? How are they going to get in trouble? And like, what does trouble look like? What are the consequences? And right now people are not being held accountable to the highest levels, so they're just keep on keeping on.
So let's get very specific, right? Any tips out there for listeners? I know I've got a wide range, a lot of social workers. For listeners who want to be change makers and disruptors in their respective spaces, and I know there's a lot of folks from the social sector here, what should we be doing to step out on faith and say, hey, no, we're not going to do things that way anymore?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the most powerful activities that I do with my teams, and it really is transformative, is even when they've identified a challenge, right? They're like, they notice that something's off. That's the first step, really paying attention. You know, what's not working well? What's been around a while? You know, what has shifted because of COVID and other, you know, intersectional pieces to the work? Just noticing what those challenges are that are bubbling up and naming them. And then thinking about who all are impacted by these challenges. We think of everything from our organizational perspective, but if we actually pause and say, who are all of the stakeholders impacted? You know, what do we hypothesize that pain and frustration must be like? So getting focused is really, really, really helpful, and getting specific is helpful. And then the next part, which people rarely do because we're not paid to not have answers, we don't like to have uncertainty, is to sit in the uncertainty. It's to enter the discomfort, to go into that space and say, what do we not know? Just call it out now. What do we not know about this challenge? What do we not know about our stakeholders? What do we need to go learn? And then going out and, you know, applying empathy, interviewing skills and other techniques to really understand. And then how do we test these solutions before we actually build them and make evidence-informed decisions? So there's a couple different steps, but that first part of identifying what is even the challenge, who is impacted, and what do we not know and need to go learn, that is really helpful because it makes people realize we don't just have to, you know, forge ahead, heads down, creating these potential solutions that are not even stakeholder informed, but we really put the stakeholder at the center of the work. And it's based on co-design and uncovering uncertainties. And that's when we can address our bias and our positionalities and all of those other pieces.
So for folks who want to learn more, right? Because one thing I wanted this platform to be is a space to learn about individuals like yourself who offer services, who have that keen eye for collaboration, co-design. How do people keep up with you, keep up with your work, potentially work with you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. They can go to the website, pauseforchange.com, sign up for the newsletter. I send out a recurring newsletter with resources, with upcoming events. So talk about Possibility Project in there as well, and just ways to engage. And then with Possibility Project, there's also a recurring newsletter that goes out to invite people to all of those different topics to continually help expand people's thinking. And the other way is that before, my work has really only been accessible to one-on-one clients around the country, but I'm writing my book. And so the book will be coming out early next year, which is exciting. And it's essentially everything I've learned in my career, but talking about the framework with a ton of case studies. Right now I have 30 different examples from work that I've done with clients, and I have about 30 more that I'm trying to figure out how to integrate without making it a massive book. But it feels so good to share the ahas and the learning, because I really want people to see what it looks like in real life and to be inspired. And then I'm, for the first time, offering online courses that have very accessible entry points, where people can engage in the work. They can receive the training and support without having to bring on a team from their entire organization and just slip into the one-on-one model, but they can access it more easily.
Now that's super exciting. And I think as we enter into a space, I've grown away from the new normal phrase. I never really liked it anyway, but just as we're hopeful for the future, right? I think conversations around social innovation have to continue to rise up, because we have entered a space now where, thinking about COVID before it even happened, thinking of like February 2020, right? The infrastructure that we created was weak, like in all aspects of society. And we saw that in the ways that different groups were more or less more vulnerable. And now that we're entering into 2022, soon 2023, we have to start thinking differently about everything, right? Like we're at a place now where pivot is okay, where we can start to imagine, to think more broadly, to invite new people to the conversation. One of the things that I did really appreciate about my doctoral program was the fact that they were using other sectors to influence the ways that social work could happen, right? Things that you could borrow from engineering, things that you could borrow from the food industry, just things that you wouldn't typically think of, but just the ways that they have different models and frameworks. And now's the time for us, if we're gonna do things right, right? And I think it's our state uses, like, we had Build Back Better, I think, before the federal conversation. But I think if we're really intentional about building back better, we have to be innovative in that process.
Absolutely. And, you know, my definition of success is learning. We have to be continually learning, and we've got to break down the separation of our learning. And if you think about within one organization, even a small organization, you know, once you grow past a handful of folks that are working towards a mission, things start to get complicated. And we don't have pathways that we've set up within organizations for people to communicate side to side, up and down. And so within one organization, you could have two departments working on the exact same challenge or issue, and they're not even talking to each other. I mean, what is that about? That it just does not make any sense. And then if you can imagine within one community, you might have 10 different agencies and organizations working on the exact same problem. And they are not only not talking to each other, they are competing for resources and withholding information from each other. And then they're hiding missteps from other organizations, from the community, from funders. And so that learning is completely isolated and trapped. And so we are just redoing the same learning over and over and over. And that's honestly one of my dreams, is I wish there could be an interactive platform where people could be even anonymous, but at least vulnerable, and they could share, this is the challenge at hand. These are the stakeholders we're focused on. These are the potential solutions we explored, and these are the outcomes. These are the rapid solution tests that we put into action. And here's the evidence that we gathered. Take it or leave it. Like, it may work. You may have to, of course, tweak and test in your own part of the country, part of the world, your organization. But right now what's happening is none of that gets out. And that just almost keep me up at night thinking about the tremendous learning that none of us ever share. And I think that really is the key to being better and to being more successful, is sharing this knowledge and having pathways and expectations and reinforcements to share that learning.
Mic drop.
Very nice.
It was great catching up. And I think, you know, as I've said already, the ways that we go forward are going to require people to just think differently. And I'm glad that you're part of the process of facilitating those thoughts.
Oh, thank you so much. And I have to get you on Possibility Project. We got to figure out what topic you want to talk about.
We're going to make it happen.
Yeah.
I'm confident.
Yes. Yeah. And honestly, if there's, you know, things you're reading, things you're thinking about, I mean, that's really how I tell the speakers, like, what's driving you just like mad right now? You're just like, oh, this is the thing. We can make it a topic and we can go there.
The thing keeping me up at night right now is the fact that everyone's resigning except me, the great resignation.
Oh, no. Here. Oh, no. I am seeing that with my local government clients right now.
Yeah.
People are just quitting left and right. I mean, people, like right now I'm working on a COVID project, and someone was asking me who they should schedule vaccine clinics with. I gave them two names and both of them were gone.
Oh,
and
no.
They seriously were just there like 4 weeks ago. And it's just, you can't keep track.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard. It's hard.
I know. It is. It's so exhausting. It's so exhausting. Oh, I appreciate you and what you do.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Until next time, Heather, take care of yourself.
Stay safe. Thank you so much.
Hey, just want to send a special thanks to Heather for joining us on the podcast. When I started thinking about social innovation and social entrepreneurship, I knew I wanted to get someone who had done this type of work previously. And working in government spaces, innovation comes up. I don't know if we always do the best job of innovating. I think we might throw a new label on something old. But to be able to hear that there are groups out there pushing the boundaries around what's possible, what's feasible, what's sustainable, I mean, that's exciting. And you want to have a government that's willing to try new things. Because we've found, quite frankly, in this era of quote-unquote post-COVID, that a lot of our infrastructure was broken to begin with. And so if we're intentional about rebuilding and creating more equitable circumstances for all, that means we need to challenge the way that we've done things that brought us to that point initially. So glad to have thought leaders out there like Heather who are willing to encourage us to think more broadly about some of the social problems that we're facing today. A few very quick updates. We're almost at the end of the road, and I mean that sincerely. I mean it with love, but I mean it sincerely. There are 3 episodes left of the Equity Matters podcast. I did record the final episode. You're in for a treat. I'll just let you know that in advance. Also, just want to point out, we are building up our relationship again with the Cummings Graduate Institute. We have a new training that will be available sometime in the spring, talking all about racial trauma, and we're going to link that to the implicit bias course. Stay tuned for updates on that. People are starting to ask me what happens after the podcast. I can tell you the first thing is I'm going to rest. I'm going to take some time off. I got a lot of creative ideas that I don't want to just jump into immediately, but I want to give them some time to be nurtured, to bounce them off of some of my thought partners and see the best way to deliver them. Is this the end of an era? Perhaps. We'll see. I think I want to leave the door open if I want to come back to podcasting, but I also want to be mindful of this may have served its purpose and it's time to do something else. And I think that's okay. I think as practitioners, sometimes we hold on to things too long, right? As creatives, the same rules apply. I think it's okay to step away for a while and to explore some other things. Also, what's coming up? So our second venture out with the Brothers in Social Work Collective will be November 19th, where we'll be partnering again with Wayne State. This time talking about some of the mental health challenges that come up when being enrolled in grad school, especially in a social work program. Topics like this, again, don't get brought up nearly enough. I think it's unfair to many of our students that there aren't safe spaces to have these type of dialogues, but I'm glad Wayne State is leading the charge in some of this. Also proud to announce the second school that we'll be partnering with in the spring. I think we finally got permission to say it out loud. So we will be working with the University of Alabama. I can't say Roll Tide because my sister went to Auburn and we don't play that in our household. So y'all know those two words that people typically say after University of Alabama. I'm not going to say it, but I am glad to be partnering with them. They are bringing Brothers in Social Work Collective out to do 2 workshops. So dates have not been confirmed yet, but it's going down in the spring. Again, I keep trying to tell y'all, if you want Brothers in Social Work Collective to come out, talk to your students, talk to your faculty, now's the time to get on our radar because booked and busy. There's at least one other school lined up. Haven't gotten the green light to share yet, but just know it's coming. Anything else? Just trying to run through my mental notes. I don't think so. Of course, just want to thank you all for rocking with us. What an adventure it's been, right? We are 71 episodes in, and that includes the I Got 5. But 71 episodes, who would have thought a little pandemic project would have turned into something like this? Surely not I. So until next time, folks, before I do the typical sign off, make sure you follow us on social media. I haven't decided how I want to keep that going after the podcast ends. I think there's still ways to create content and be educational and informational. Even if there aren't podcast episodes or new ones attached to it, I might reference people to old ones. That's something that's been brought up a few times. Like, you never reference old episodes. Well, I can do that. So follow us on social media. That is at Equity Matters Podcast on Instagram, at Equity Matters PC on Twitter. And hey, we'll talk soon. And of course, you know, equity matters.